Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Relative peace has descended over that part of the former Yugoslavia known today as Bosnia. Only a few years ago, this area witnessed some of the most egregious attempts at ethnic cleansing the world has witnessed since the Holocaust. Peace has been attributed to a series of agreements reached at the Dayton Air Force Base in the United States, known as the Dayton Accords. In a moment, Talking History's Terry Clark will revisit the making of those accords. But before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. At 8:15 on the morning of August 6, 1945, the bomb that heralded the beginning of the atomic age, Little Boy, was dropped on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, population 350,000. Hiroshima was selected as the first target for the new weapon because it was untouched by United States strategic bombing. American military leaders reasoned that since the city had been left unblemished, the damage caused by the atom bomb could be accurately assessed. Further, they expected tremendous destruction from the bomb, and it would be more impressive, thereby forcing the Japanese government to surrender, saving the lives of hundreds of thousands of American soldiers poised to invade the Japanese homeland. Delivered by a U.S. B-29 bomber known as the Enola Gay, Little Boy was detonated 1,900 feet above the ground, sending a fireball downward whose temperatures approached several million degrees centigrade. An area of 13 square kilometers was reduced to ashes. 63% of the city's buildings were destroyed, and a third of the city's civilian population was immediately killed or fatally wounded. And among the survivors, the long-term effects of nuclear radiation, radiation sickness, genetic and chromosome injury, and birth defects plagued them for the rest of their lives. On August 9th, another atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, and 5 days later, the Japanese surrendered. In 1998, a librarian searching the Connecticut Historical Society's storage area stumbled on a flag that she believed was in Abraham Lincoln's theater box on the night he was assassinated. 3 years later, her suspicions had been verified. The 6-foot square silk flag, which has a painted eagle as well as stars and stripes on it, was presented to the U.S. Treasury Guard Regiment by the ladies of the Treasury Department in 1864. It was one of 5 flags that surrounded Lincoln's box that fateful evening in April 1865, and quite likely one he actually clutched when he was shot. You're listening to Talking History. The Dayton Accords have been credited with bringing peace to war-torn Bosnia. Is that actually the case? If so, why, when all other efforts failed? If not, is another round of fighting imminent? Here to discuss the creation and effects of the Dayton Accords is Terry Clark.
Most of us remember the horrifying pictures coming out of Bosnia-Herzegovina some years ago. Almost 40 years after the Holocaust, Europe was once again experiencing ethnic cleansing. After repeated efforts to resolve the conflict and bring an end to the inhumane brutality associated with it, an agreement was finally reached at Dayton Air Force Base in Ohio. Since then, Bosnia has rarely, if ever, been the focus of a nightly news report. It would appear as if the Dayton Accords have accomplished their purpose. Here today to discuss the Dayton Accords with us is Dr. David Chandler, a research fellow at the Policy Research Institute at Leeds Metropolitan University in Leeds, England. He is the author of Bosnia, Faking Democracy After Dayton. It's in its second print and published by Pluto Press. Welcome to our show, Dr. Chandler.
Thank you, Terry.
David, perhaps you could tell us, what are the Dayton Accords exactly, and when were they signed?
The Dayton Accords is an agreement between the Bosnian government and the governments of Croatia and of Serbia, the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And they were signed at the end of 1995. As you say, initially, they were initialed at the Dayton Air Force Base in Ohio, then officially signed in Paris in December. And quite uniquely for a peace agreement, the accords went far beyond the usual agreement on military forces, but actually tried to establish a new political entity, the State of Bosnia. And at the time, it was seen as the most ambitious peace agreement that had ever been attempted. as I say, not just drawing lines to establish the peace, but also setting up a new country, establishing the constitution, banking regulations, legislation for the judiciary, and for the social and political system.
These accords that were signed finally at Dayton, they were really the culmination of several attempts to achieve some sort of a peace agreement, were they not?
They were, yeah. They were preceded by the Bosnian War from 92 to 95, about 3.5 years of war in Bosnia. And there were earlier attempts to agree a peace settlement before then. But I think one of the main problems had been that the international community weren't all batting on the same wicket, and that America and the European Union had a different view as to the shape of the settlement. America was much more keen on supporting Izetbegovic, the Bosnian Muslim leader, and the European community were more keen on a negotiated settlement. And I think it was disagreements within the international community that meant it was difficult to get a settlement within Bosnia itself.
Were the difficulties in reaching the agreement, were they purely difficulties in negotiations to get the parties at the table to agree, or did they also involve the parties on the ground that were in Bosnia itself?
I think there was both elements to it, really. I mean, if you remember, when the Bosnian War kicked off, it was part of the process of a whole series of conflicts around the disintegration of the Yugoslav state. And prior to it, the republics of Croatia and Slovenia had been recognized initially by Germany, but then other states in the international community. And at the time of that recognition, a lot of policy advisors from the UN, the European Union, and the American leaders as well were very wary about recognizing these two republics and splitting up the Yugoslav Federation without a series of agreements that would cover the whole of Yugoslavia. So that meant that Bosnia was in a difficult situation, where the Bosnian Croats would rather be part of Croatia, and the Bosnian Serbs wanted to be part of Serbia, and the Bosnian Muslims were torn in between them, and the institutional settlement in Bosnia itself came under a lot of pressure and eventually collapsed. But even then, there had been initial attempts at agreement. In 1992, the European Union had got a Lisbon Agreement, and that was signed by the three Bosnian parties, but the Muslim leader Izetbegovic rejected it after talks with the American leadership. And I think that there was a difference in opinions in the international community as to what exactly was the cause of the Bosnian conflict. Was it external invasion? Was it ethnic disagreements, something innate to Bosnia? Or and the minority view was that, in fact, this was an inevitable process once all the constitutional mechanisms that guaranteed different rights had been dismantled with the dismantling of the Yugoslav state. But actually, during the war, as I said, the Europeans tended much more to see that the Croats, the Serbs, and the Muslims as all legitimate representatives, and the American government had a view that the Muslim leadership and were more legitimate, and that a unified Bosnian state was the only way to go, as opposed to a much more federated one. However, the resolution to the conflict and the run-up to the Dayton Agreement came when the American government altered its position and went for a settlement, first of all through organizing a Muslim Croat Federation in 1994, creating a ceasefire between the Croats and the Muslims, and then once that federation had been agreed, supporting the struggle against the Serbian side, or what was in the future to become Republika Srpska. And as you probably know, NATO forces were used in that struggle as well, and eventually all three sides were brought to the table in Dayton.
The Dayton Accords, are they succeeding fairly well at this point?
Well, there's a lot of disagreement about that, and in fact, every conference that's organized around Dayton, on the one hand, the international community would argue that Dayton's been very successful. On the other hand, they'd also argue there's still a long way to go. I mean, if you look at recent events in Bosnia, you can see that the most recent elections in November 2000 resulted in the main nationalist parties achieving quite a high level of support. The main Croatian nationalist party had the majority of support amongst Bosnian Croats. The main Serbian nationalist party had the majority of support amongst Bosnian Serbs. But the international community has been successful to a certain extent, in that the political institutions that do operate in Bosnia, at a state and at an entity level, are dominated by more moderate party coalitions. And that's happened through international pressure and the threat of economic sanctions. So in Republika Srpska, none of the main nationalist party had positions of power in the assembly, and there's a government basically of technocrats led by a prime minister from the moderate party. And in the federation, the presidential candidate from the Bosnian Croats and the leader of the main nationalist party, he's been sacked from his post by the international high representative, and quite a few other leading Croats have been dismissed as well. So you can see that, you know, it's pretty much up in the air. On paper, it looks as if quite a lot has been resolved, but actually in practice, there's been very little overcoming of ethnic divisions within Bosnia.
What about the problem of violence? That would appear to be at least one of the successes of the Dayton Accords, is it not?
That's true. The Dayton Accords ended the conflict within Bosnia, but a lot of people would say that the Accords weren't too different from the original agreement that was signed in 1992. And if the Americans had been on side with the Europeans, there wouldn't have been a war to start with, because it was only a prevention of agreement between the Bosnian parties. Because with American support, the Muslim leadership thought that international intervention would mean that they'd get a better deal than a deal that was done at the negotiating table. And I think that's quite often been the problem in Bosnia and the rest of the Balkans as well, that once these problems and conflicts have been internationalized, the minority party or the party that might not do so well in a negotiated settlement has an incentive to continue the conflict and hope to get international engagement to promote its position.
What are the problems? You know, we've talked about the succeed with the issue of violence, but there appear to be, based on what you're telling me here, perhaps some political problems?
Well, yeah, I don't think there's a problem of violence. Bosnia is a fairly small state, and the balance of power between the international community and Bosnian factions is so great that there's no potential towards conflict. And the people in Bosnia would much rather have a peaceful solution than a violent solution. But, I mean, at the end of the day, there's no alternatives on the table apart from the Dayton Agreement and cooperation with the international community. The problem has been that the international framework that's been imposed on Dayton has been a fairly artificial one. I mean, the agreement itself was drawn up mainly by the American State Department and the international community. It wasn't assented to by Bosnian parties. And in fact, even today, if you had a referendum in Bosnia on support for state institutions, probably the majority of the population would argue that there should be changes and that they'd rather have the boundaries redrawn. And international rule hasn't overcome those barriers, because the political institutions, the institutions where the Bosnian Croats, Muslim and Serbian representatives meet and potentially could negotiate a solution that would be accountable to people within the region, those political institutions have really just existed on paper only. The policies have been imposed from the top down by the High Representative, by the OSCE, by the UN, and it's really meant that there's been no political basis to get an agreement and to overcome those fairly narrow and parochial ethnic allegiances.
Are you saying that, in essence, that the population, whether it be ethnically Croat, Serb, or Bosnian Muslim of Bosnia and Herzegovina, in essence, are not participating in the building of a democracy?
Yeah, I think that's been the central problem. And in fact, if you look at the way that elections work in Bosnia, it's sort of the opposite of the way that elections work in Western countries. In the West, you have an election to test the popularity of the government, to test different policies that the government's putting forward. And in Bosnia, obviously the policies are drawn up by the international community and the international institutions. It doesn't really matter which political parties get the most votes. And what's really being tested in these elections is the international community's confidence in the Bosnian people. And there's an idea that if they vote for nationalist parties, obviously they're not quite mature enough, not really ready for democracy and self-government. And so the tests, ironically, really, a test of the people as opposed to the test of government. And because the international community policies are imposed, not just at state and entity government levels, but also at the level of the cantons in the federation and at the lower level municipalities, there's sort of a dual system of power in a way, where you have elections. In fact, you have more elections in Bosnia than probably anywhere else. Every 2 years, they have general elections there. You have all these elections, but that the power is still in the hands of the international community that make all the real decisions, which means that there's, as I say, there's very little input by Bosnian people into the decision-making process. And I think that really feeds support for the nationalist parties, because that really draws on the insecurities of people. Because if all the decisions are in the hands of the international community, it means that if or when the international community withdraws, everything's still up for question. And without any settlement that's accountable to people in the region, there's little hope really for any sustainable and long-term settlement apart from this one that's been artificially imposed.
How strong have the nationalist parties become?
Well, the nationalist parties are dominant in all three communities. Perhaps the Bosnian Muslim community, a moderate party, narrowly pipped the main nationalist Muslim party there. But definitely within the Serb and the Croatian communities, the main nationalist parties are fairly dominant. But it's not because these people in Bosnia are sort of raving nationalists or anything. In fact, the whole mood politically is really one of pessimism. I think that the vote for nationalist parties, as I say, is more from a lack of hope for the future and one of pessimism, one of atomization and exclusion from the political process. And that's what the real problem is. Whereas those election results are then interpreted internationally or by international monitors as actually saying that the problem isn't with them. The problem really must lie with the Bosnian people or Bosnian culture or the lack of some democratic education, which I think is firstly a rather patronizing view about people in Bosnia, and also it's a very self-excusing one where all the problems are seen to lie with Bosnian people, and the international community takes very little accountability or responsibility for the problems in the republic, in the state there.
What about the issue of the war criminals like Radovan Karadzic? What's happened to them? What's been their fate?
Well, the situation is that it's been the war criminal issue has been a difficult one, because even though the issue has been played upon internationally as a way mainly of criminalizing the main nationalist parties and associating them with alleged crimes during the war, the thing is that domestically in Bosnia, also in Serbia and in Croatia, there's a very different understanding of the conflict, and people who are seen internationally to be war criminals are respected within those communities and seen as patriots, really, in the same way as when you have discussions about war crimes that maybe America or Britain has been involved in. You know, it's very difficult to say that, sort of carpet bombing in Iraq or during the Second World War are crimes, as opposed to, you know, valid acts in a time of conflict. And it's been difficult to try and get the confidence of the population or the communities in the Balkans, as well as emphasize the war criminals aspect. And if elected governments in that part of the world were to hand over national heroes, they'd pretty soon lose their popularity and their electoral legitimacy. So it's been a very difficult question. I mean, as I say, it's been used to put pressure on governments in the Balkans, but it's difficult to really follow that through, because in the end you'd be discrediting governments and political parties that really would like to cooperate and work with the West, but it's like signing their own sort of political death warrant in a way to sort of criticize their part in the struggle in the fragmentation of Yugoslavia.
You said in answer to a previous question that that there's a pessimism now that's prevalent among the people of Bosnia-Herzegovina about their future. What about you? Do you share that pessimism, or do you have a more optimistic view on what may potentially come about there?
Ultimately, I think that the situation in Bosnia will improve, and that there's a good chance that the Balkan region will gradually be integrated within European political and economic structures. But I see it as being a very slow process, and a process in which the sort of extensive regulation by international institutions in that region is really institutionalizing divisions and a low level of political engagement and involvement, as opposed to motivating any sort of change. And in one way, I am quite pessimistic, because it seems that the longer international regulation of Bosnia goes on for, the less political autonomy there is, the less authority Bosnian political institutions have. And I think that that's going to really set back the process of development and of creating a more viable and long-term solution. But nevertheless, because the whole attraction for any politicians in the Balkans, in Bosnia and in other states, is integration within Europe and involvement in those wider structures and gaining foreign investment, I think that pull will eventually overcome the barriers of international policy in the region.
Dave, I thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You have been listening to Dr. David Chandler, a research fellow at the Policy Research Institute at Leeds Metropolitan University in Leeds, England.
Alexander Hamilton was the nation's first Secretary of the Treasury. His goal was to build a stable economy. For the most part, he succeeded. Nevertheless, he is the least well-known and the least loved, as Jeffrey Paisley tells us, of all the founding fathers. Paisley is a professor of history at the University of Missouri, Columbia. He's the author of The Tyranny of Printers, Newspaper Politics in the Early American Republic.
The founders of the United States have had their reputations battered in recent years, but they have always had their defenders. When George Washington got left out of the national history standards and Thomas Jefferson's DNA patterns were found in the wrong bloodstream, our leading political and cultural conservatives rushed to the rescue. Pity poor Alexander Hamilton, then, for the founders' friends have forsaken him. His one prominent memorial, his portrait on the $10 bill, is under attack. A well-connected conservative organization, the very same one that added Ronald Reagan's name to Washington National Airport, has begun a drive to put Reagan's face on the 10th spot instead. Hamilton has long been the least loved of the founders. His major accomplishments were in the unromantic area of public finance. Though Hamilton wanted to be a national hero like Washington or Jefferson, he chose to seek fame as a bureaucrat, a Treasury secretary, rather than as a popular politician. Moreover, he rarely minced words about his tough-minded views. Popular unrest over taxes? The government should appear like Hercules with troops, Hamilton said, and show the punks who was boss. Wages too high for factories to be feasible? Hire women and children. The Constitution? A frail and worthless fabric whose exact wording needed to be largely ignored if it was to survive at all. Hamilton's main objective in public life was to build a stable national state that could prosper in a hostile, heavily armed world. And at this, he largely succeeded. But while Americans have always enjoyed feeling rich, powerful, and safe, they tend to chafe at the policies necessary to make that so. Thus, Hamilton has never caught on with the culture. Mount Vernon and Monticello have become popular tourist destinations, while Hamilton's home, The Grange, sits tucked behind a church in a blighted section of northern New York City. Builders of governments are hard to love, especially for those who hate government. The source of the effort to take Hamilton out of our wallets is the Ronald Reagan Legacy Project, an arm of the anti-tax group Americans for Tax Reform. ATR is the nerve center of a so-called Leave Us Alone coalition of right-wing groups that meet every week to plot their next moves. They look forward to tax cuts so deep that the government will have to sell the airports and water treatment plants to pay for them. On the surface, it's easy to see why people like this would be repelled by Hamilton, whose great concern was to firmly establish the government that they hate so much. If the Whiskey Rebellion were held today, the ATR people would certainly be out shooting up the revenue collector's house, not marching west with Hamilton's army. Yet at the same time, a Republican-led drive to erase Hamilton from the national memory represents a significant shift in the autobiography of American conservatism. It was the Republican administration of Calvin Coolidge, after all, that put Hamilton's face on the tin in the first place. And there's a lot for conservatives to like about Hamilton. He invented trickle-down economics, viewing intensive development in the creation of large fortunes as ultimately good for the nation, however unequally the benefits might be distributed. From the excise tax on whiskey to the funding at face value of a depressed national debt, Hamilton's famous financial system transferred significant amounts of wealth to a financial elite that he hoped would support the new government simply because they were profiting by it. Also, consider Hamilton the inventor of the organized religious right in America. He once suggested a network of Christian constitutional societies to help citizens know that God wanted them to vote Federalist. Why, then, the drive to erase him from our money? Removing Hamilton from the national pantheon meets a critical ideological need for anti-government extremists. Hamilton presents them with an uncomfortable contradiction. He was a great American white male, a founding father, no less, who recognized that there were public goods that only governments could accomplish. Hamilton would have found absurd the opposition that modern conservatives make between government activity on the one hand and human liberty on the other. Hamilton understood that government exists to protect liberty, but that is a fact that today's conservatives prefer to sidestep, unless, that is, liberty happens to be threatened in some profitable spot like the oil fields of Kuwait.
You've been listening to Jeffrey Paisley, co-editor of the forthcoming book, Beyond the Founders, New Approaches to the Political History of the Early American Republic. This is Talking History. Earlier in the show, we told you about the recently discovered flag that was in the presidential box the night Abraham Lincoln was shot. For our site of the week, Talking History's Cindy Workman tells you where you can see it.
The Connecticut Historical Society in Hartford has a wonderful selection of exhibits, including the Civil War Treasures, which features memorabilia and objects associated with President Lincoln, including the flag that was on the rail at the theater when Lincoln was assassinated. The exhibit also contains both rare and everyday items that tell the story about life on the battlefield and back home in Connecticut. There are many other sites to see at the Connecticut Historical Society, including Amistad, A True Story of Freedom, and a hands-on history gallery that gives kids a chance to explore history with their eyes, nose, ears, and hands. The nonprofit museum is the seventh oldest historical society in the U.S. and houses one of the best collections in New England.
Finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, there are two History Channel programs coming up that you might enjoy. On August 16th, watch for Drake's Secret Voyage. Between 1577 and 1580, Sir Francis Drake did what no commander had yet done. He sailed around the world. But instead of publicly celebrating this historic feat, accounts of his voyage were mysteriously covered up by his investor, Queen Elizabeth I. In Drake's Secret Voyage, historians debate the reasons for this secrecy, as well as what he may have discovered along the way that was never revealed. On August 18th, the History Channel will look at the history of prostitution. Once upon a time, being a prostitute carried no stigma. In certain cities in ancient Greece, they were associated with sacred activities at temples to the gods. Even in the American West, there was a degree of tolerance. So what happened? Prostitution, Sex in the City investigates the changing social position of these ladies of the night. Check your local listings for the exact showtimes of these History Channel programs. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oh.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.